Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live, Saturdays from 9 to noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio 102.7 FM in BC, Canada. For more information, check out www.vcn.bc.ca/redeye. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
As another anthrax case in New York is the topic of front page media stories, fears are rising in the United States about the imminent threat of biological terrorism. However, until recently, most U.S. citizens gave minimal thought to biological weapons and even less to the role of their country in the proliferation of them. According to a recent paper by Edward Hammond, biological and chemical weapons are an integral part of U.S. foreign policy, and associated with that policy, the U.S. is blocking a comprehensive ban of these devastating weapons. Edward Hammond is on the staff of the U.S. Office of the Sunshine Project, a small international nonprofit organization dedicated to biological weapons control. And he joins me on the phone this morning from his home in Texas. Good morning, Edward.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Welcome to Red Eye. Before we get into the larger role of the United States in biological and chemical warfare, I'd be interested to hear your assessment of the current anthrax cases in Florida and New York.
Yeah, well, it's very interesting, and I think there's no denying that it's very frightening. Certainly, anthrax and a number of other typical bioweapons agents can be quite deadly. I think it's important, though, to put it in perspective. So far, I would characterize what seems to have happened as something sort of like what happened with the Unabomber in the United States several years ago. And it's very clear that if, in fact, these were a terrorist attack, that the person that did them or the people that did them certainly didn't have any great experience or technical knowledge of biological weapons. So thus far, I think it doesn't really change the reality that the primary preoccupation with respect to the threat of use of biological weapons really comes from states and not from individuals. Because in the end, what's happened so far with respect to biological terrorism really isn't any different than any other type of weapon which terrorists have used in the past.
Now, if we could describe those recent uses of anthrax as possibly as amateurish, what would be the potential of biological and chemical weapons if they're used in a more expert way?
Oh, it's quite substantial. It's important to remember that it really does require quite a bit of technical knowledge in order to use them effectively. The possibilities are quite immense. Really relatively small quantities of some types of particularly lethal agents can kill or infect a very large number of people, but they have to be applied in very particular ways and under very particular conditions in order to be effective. And so far we haven't seen that there are any quote-unquote terrorist organizations or any organizations outside of governments that really possess that means.
What are the current U.S. policies that relate to the control of biological and chemical weapons?
In many senses, the U.S. is its own worst enemy on chemical and biological weapons control. The U.S. did ratify and is a member, along with most other countries, of the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention. And that's the major international agreement which does prohibit the development of biological weapons. Unfortunately, biological weapons are a bit different than some other types of weaponry in that offensive and defensive research can be very difficult to distinguish. There are also a number of people within the U.S. government that have a very blurry idea of the fact that under international law, all biological weapons, in fact, are prohibited. And so you see various initiatives which, in fact, are destabilizing coming out of the U.S. government related to non-lethal weapons, related to using biological weapons in the drug war, and related to certain kinds of biodefense research which can be indistinguishable from offensive biological weapons work, and which can be very destabilizing and, in fact, have been destabilizing on international controls.
How does this compare with a history of biological weapons control in the United States, their policies, say, 20 years ago?
Well, in the U.S. renounced offensive biological weapons research and in fact did largely dismantle its program after 1969. It was renounced by President Nixon. It's important to understand that it wasn't an altruistic move. It was sparked by, for various reasons, mainly among them was a desire to not see other countries invest heavily in biological weapons because they can rival the power of nuclear weapons. Also from the perspective of a major well-armed nuclear power like the United States, biological weapons are relatively unpredictable, so they're not a particularly good weapon to have in the arsenal of a country which is already very, very powerful in the context of the Cold War, which was happening at that time. Now what we're seeing, and it has particularly to do with some of the types of political conflicts that are prevalent after the end of the Cold War and the U.S. response to them, and with the rise of biotechnology, there's been a significant erosion of the clarity of the U.S.'s purpose with respect to biological weapons. And in fact, you have spectacles like one which happened earlier this year where members of the U.S. military went to a meeting on non-lethal weapons, which was held in Scotland, and called for a renegotiation of the Biological Weapons Convention because there are types of biological weapons which some elements of the U.S. government would like to develop.
Can you elaborate a bit more then on what the role the U.S. has taken in global attempts to develop effective biological weapons control?
Sure. Well, the Biological and Toxin Weapons Convention, which has been in existence since the early 70s, prohibits the development of biological weapons. But unlike other major international arms control agreements, there's no mechanism to enforce the Biological Weapons Convention. It's always been a sort of honor system. And starting about 7 years ago, countries entered into negotiations to develop what's called a verification protocol, to develop a system whereby UN inspectors would go and look at facilities across the world that were suspected of developing biological weapons. Now, the U.S. sort of half-heartedly participated in these talks for 6 years. And then, unfortunately, just a few months ago, when the negotiations were reaching their end and an agreement was very close that was a very broadly supported agreement across the world, the U.S. pulled out. The reasons that they cited for pulling out were the potential that spies could get in on UN inspection teams which were coming into the U.S. and compromise the biotechnology industry's trade secrets, which I think is a real perversion of governmental priorities. They're effectively saying that security from biological weapons is not as important as the profits of the biotechnology industry. And beyond that, from withdrawing from the verification protocol, they used what's basically a procedural trick. The negotiating group, which is working on the verification system, which has broad support, as I said earlier, requires a consensus in order to adopt the text. And the U.S. said, we will withdraw our support from these negotiations, and we will continue to sit in the negotiations to prohibit the rest of the world from going ahead without us. So it was a very, very sad spectacle. It came only a few weeks before September 11th. It's a decision that one would hope that major elements of the U.S. government now regret. Unfortunately, it's not clear if they do regret it, and we have an upcoming very important meeting in November, and we will see what the U.S. position is then.
Now I think, Edward, that you mentioned when they withdrew from this renegotiation, they were or when they were calling for this renegotiation of the work that was being done towards the convention, they had their own initiatives which they thought should not be prohibited. Can you elaborate on what some of those
There's a number of things. I mentioned them just briefly before. I can go into a little bit more detail. There are a number of things that the U.S. is doing which are in effect developing biological weapons or conducting activities that are indistinguishable from developing biological weapons. One which we've worked on the most at the Sunshine Project is there's a big push underway to develop fungi and other types of microorganisms to attack marijuana, cannabis, coca, and opium poppy crops. And the idea is that we'll use these in forcible eradication programs in Colombia against the Taliban in Afghanistan and in other parts of the world. We view this as a serious destabilization. Under law, you can't say, well, this is a good biological weapon because we're targeting against drugs. The prohibition on biological weapons is absolute. And once you start tinkering with that and try to use it, for example, in the middle of a very complicated conflict in Colombia, which is very tightly tied to counterinsurgency, you have, in effect, started down a slippery slope. Another area which we've focused on, which is a very frightening one, is the area of non-lethal weapons. And in non-lethal weapons, it essentially stems from what happened to the U.S. Marine Corps and the U.S. military in Somalia in the early 90s. If you recall, there were a number of U.S. troops who were killed by, in situations involving a large number of rioting civilians. And so in response, the Marine Corps has headed up a program in the United States to develop new kinds of riot control agents. And some of the riot control agents that they're looking at are, in fact, chemical and biological weapons and can be quite frightening. For example, one thing that they're studying are synthetic opioids, opioids being of the same class of chemicals that's in heroin, for example, to be sprayed on a crowd. Muscle relaxants to be sprayed on a crowd, and they've gone beyond looking at the chemicals themselves and have invested in contracts with the defense contractor to develop a mortar round which will explode over the head of a rioting crowd and disperse a chemical agent. These we view as being potentially very destabilizing to controls on weapons. And I think that although the U.S. military views it as a humane act to dose somebody with a mind-altering drug as opposed to killing them, I think that certainly from the perspective of a civilian who is out not necessarily rioting, just protesting, having their freedom of thought and their freedom of expression suppressed in that way would be is a very violent act, and it's something which would be likely to result in some sort of reaction from that person. And in fact, this is a weakness in non-lethal weapons that's been identified since at least the 1950s when Eisenhower, when he was president of the U.S., discouraged their development because he saw the potential for the use of chemical and biological non-lethals as leading to a much more serious war involving lethal chemical and biological weapons. And I have great fear that right now the U.S. military is launching us down that path, and in the end it could be very, very destabilizing.
What link should we be making, Edward, between the between bioweaponry and the proliferation of genetic engineering?
Yeah, well, certainly there is an enormous potential in genetic engineering to create new and different kinds of biological weapons. Some of the things which are technically possible would be to change the behavior of a known biological weapons agent so that it exhibits different symptoms, so that people are not readily treatable because medical personnel don't recognize what's happening. It's possible to transfer genes between organisms and create entirely new types of biological weapons. I think that certainly genetic engineering and also the natural variability of biological weapons themselves, and incidentally, biological weapons aren't just anthrax or smallpox, the ones that you've been hearing of lately, but really they're a whole range, a huge, huge number of weapons, because really it's just the use of disease to achieve political or military ends. And so if you think about what's happened in the UK recently with hoof and mouth, there are a number of other diseases which can be very damaging, which can be used as weapons. And in the end, when you talk about defending against biological weapons, you're talking about defending against disease in its entirety. And it's a really important point to understand in our response to this, because ultimately security against the use of biological weapons cannot be military or technical. ultimately it's political, because what you're confronting is an infinite enemy, in effect, because of genetic engineering and because of the variability of nature itself. There will always be some sort of pathogen. And if you solve anthrax, for example, which I think is many billions of dollars and many years away, just for that one solution, it only points to another, to another, to another. And although it's a little bit depressing to think that the threat from biological weapons is as large as it is, and genetic engineering has extended it exponentially, it's also empowering, because then you understand that there is no military solution to the threat. There is no technical solution to the threat, because the only technical solution that would work would be to vanquish disease in its entirety. And that's not going to happen. We don't have the ability to do that. So the solution is political, and that leads to more sane and safe approaches to dealing with the threat.
Well, Edward, thank you very much this morning. I think you've been extremely helpful for me in increasing my understanding of the issues, and it's been very useful.
Oh, well, thank you very much.
Now, I'll point people, I know that you have an email campaign, and I'll point people towards your website. Thanks.
Great, that would be wonderful.
I've been speaking with Edward Hammond. Edward Hammond is a staff member at the Sunshine Project U.S. office in Texas. For more information on the Sunshine Project, you can check out their website at www.sunshine-project.org.
The radio piece you just heard was broadcast on Red Eye Vancouver Co-op Radio in BC, Canada. For more information, email redeye@vcn.bc.ca. I'm Peter Royce.